Hey, good evening. Well, it's good. It's been such a light, untaxing day that we can look at this light, uncontroversial subject there. I guess as a conference committee and thinking about the conference and thinking that most people at the conference are mainly Bible teachers, church leaders, pastors, we thought it'd be helpful to from time to time to touch on particular topics maybe that you're grappling with or come up, I guess, in your ministry. And so this is one such area, evangelism and social action, and the interaction between the two, how they best relate to each other, and how we can be involved in both in our ministries, in our churches. I guess, personally, my interest in this topic is twofold. As Eddie was saying, I did my master's on this in IBI. My dissertation was on developing an applied theology of social action for today's Ireland. It is available in IBI if you've got a boring day and you want to, you know, read it. Looking at it from an academic point of view, but then also as a pastor. I'm pastor of a church in Wexford, independent evangelical church. And I guess just thinking through how can we, as a church in Wexford, how can we be a blessing to our community? How can we serve those in need in our area? And how do we integrate that with our evangelism? What does it really look like to love the people in our town, in our area? So coming at it from both those ends and trying to ground it in an Irish context then as well. How does it look here in Ireland, given our history, given our context? How can they both best relate to each other? So I thought, I guess this evening in looking at it, I want to look at it in two areas, or consider two different two parts to it. The first is to consider our context and our history. In the past, how have evangelicals in Ireland managed this relationship between evangelism and social action? That has a bearing on how we think about it, but also on how we might be received in our communities. So I want to look, first of all, kind of at a sweep of history, and particularly highlighting the interaction between evangelism and social action in our history in this country. And then, secondly, then, in the second part, just to consider the question how evangelism and social action relate together, or how they ought to relate. First of all, though, it's important to say that it is pretty much universally accepted at the moment, as believers, we are called to be involved in both evangelism and social action. And by social action, using that term, I mean social involvement, or whatever term you might want to put on it, basically a concern to provide for the physical needs of people, or on a macro level to challenge economic or political structures in a society. Tim Chester wrote a book called Good News to the Poor, and in it he makes the case why as Christians we're called to be involved in social action. He talks about it as being consistent with three things. He says it's consistent with the character of God, and gives references in the Old Testament in Psalm 146 verse 7 to 9 says, "He upholds the cause of the oppressed and gives food to the hungry. The Lord sets prisoners free. The Lord gives sight to the blind. The Lord lifts up those who are bowed down. The Lord loves the righteous. The Lord watches over the alien and sustains the fatherless and the widow, but he frustrates the ways of the wicked." And as you look at the Old Testament, the laws which God gave, they reflect his character. The laws regarding the dignity and needs of widows, orphans, the outcasts in society, the law of gleaning, the prohibition on charging interest on loans to the poor, so on in the Old Testament. It reflects the character of God, and he expects us to do the same then. Proverbs 31 says, "Speak up for those who cannot speak for themselves, for the rights of all who are destitute. Speak up and judge fairly. Defend the rights of the poor and needy." And in the New Testament, James 1:27, religion that God our Father accepts as pure and faultless is this: to look after orphans and widows in their distress, and to keep oneself from being polluted by the world. So it's consistent with the character of God. It's consistent with the reign of God. We're called to bring our lives under the rule of God in every area, which includes how we relate to the poor, the needy, how we act as citizens. 1 John 3:17 says, if anyone has material possessions and sees his brother in need but has no pity on him, how can the love of God be in him? Dear children, let us not love with words or tongue, but with actions and in truth. So consistent with the character of God, the reign of God, and then also the grace of God. The Old Testament laws, I mentioned, were rooted in their experience of freedom from slavery, experience of God's grace. Deuteronomy 24:21 says, when you harvest the grapes in your vineyard, do not go over the vines again. Leave what remains for the alien, the fatherless, and the widow. Remember that you were slaves in Egypt. That is why I command you to do this. And in the same way, in the New Testament, our attitude to the poor reveals a lot of our understanding of God's grace and our experience of God's grace. In the parable of the sheep and the goats in Matthew 25, he says, I was hungry and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger and you invited me in. When we've known and we've received mercy from God while an undeserving enemy of God, we will have a heart of love for the most ungrateful, difficult people. It creates a spontaneous generosity in us. So that's just by way of how do we make the case biblically. And I think we would all be in agreement on that. That in the Bible, it does call us to social action. It's consistent with the character of God, the reign of God, and the grace of God. But the question remains, how does it relate then to our evangelism? How does our desire to love people practically and provide for physical needs, how does that relate to our evangelism and our desire spiritually to see people respond to God's gift of grace? So that's by way of introduction, but let me look at those two areas I mentioned. First of all, our context, our history, and then looking at the question itself, how we relate the two. I don't know how fond you are of history. I studied history in Trinity, so I love it. So bear with me as I indulge my love of history. If you hate it, sorry, you can switch on again in about 10 minutes. But the historical overview, our historical context. Back 19th century was a time of real robust, socially active evangelicalism. I'm sure you're all familiar with the situation in England at that time, names like Wilberforce, Shaftesbury, Newton, and many others, who were at the forefront of social campaigns against slavery, alleviating poverty. Well, in Ireland as well, evangelicalism was very strong in the 19th century. And, you know, as Irish evangelicals today, in many ways we've forgotten our heritage of Irish evangelicalism in the 19th century. Names are not as familiar to us as the names of the English evangelicals. Names like Peter Rowe from Kilkenny, who was one of the great preachers, preached for Wilberforce and Newton. John Gregg, who had a church where Trinity Church is in town, and hundreds of people coming into his church preaching to the poor in the city. Or Archbishop Trench, the Archbishop of Tuam, Church of Ireland, who filled Connacht with evangelical clergy. To the extent that in 1840, half of the 2,000 Church of Ireland clergy in Ireland were evangelical. And the Irish church was the most evangelical in Anglicanism. They also enthusiastically embraced the Irish language, many of them preaching in Irish. The chair of Irish at Trinity College was established in 1844 by an evangelical, a guy called Monk Mason. So many of these names have just disappeared, but were very prominent in the 19th century. And as well as societies like the Bible and Tract Distribution Organization, Sunday School Societies, these evangelicals were at the forefront of championing prison reform, the care of the deaf and dumb, relief of destitute widows, and then setting up soup kitchens. Particularly in the area of education, setting up schools, providing teachers, and much of it, again, through the Irish language. In 1818, the organisation called the Irish Society for Promoting the Education of the Native Irish through the medium of their own language. Snappy titles back then, you know? Was established. And many of the schools that they set up were on the landlord's estates. If the landlord was evangelical, which many of them were, and many of the evangelicals came from the aristocracy, names like Latouche and the Guinness family and the Paris courts, not far from here. If the landlord was evangelical, they were likely to fund the school, provide the books and the teachers, and it would be on their estate. Many of the Church of Ireland evangelical churches had their own dispensaries, schools, libraries, and a whole network of support for the local community. As in England, so in Ireland, it was a robust, socially active evangelicalism. Of course, the real test of it came in the mid-1800s, in the Great Famine, 1845-49. Without doubt, that was and has been Ireland's hour of greatest need. The immediate causes of the famine, of course, were the failure of the potato crop, a fungal disease. There were other factors, the economic policies of the government and the slowness of the government's response. But from 1845 to 51, the population fell by 2.25 million. It's thought about 1 million died and 1 million emigrated. So 1 million from starvation and disease died. The after effects of the famine changed the landscape of Ireland, literally changed the practice of land division, hastened the demise of the Irish language, and added momentum to the call for independence. Many of the evangelicals across different denominations were involved in bringing relief of the famine. Many of them worked sacrificially to alleviate the suffering. But unfortunately, the good work of many of them has been overshadowed by those who used the physical need to force the hand of people spiritually. The practice that became known as superism. I'm sure you've heard of it. Superism, offering food in exchange for conversion, or as a strong inducement to attend Bible reading classes or send children to Protestant schools. About 4 or 5 years ago, in 2007, there was a book published called Famine Echoes. The editor was a guy called Porter. And in this, he edited interviews that were done by the Folklore Commission in the 1940s. So interviews in the 1940s with elderly people who were retelling the stories that they had heard from survivors of the famine. And in the book, just published four years ago, there's a whole chapter on superism. I'm just going to read you part of the introduction. He says, "Most controversially, during the sectarian tensions of the period in general, and during the famine years in particular, the evangelical groups were accused of providing relief to the distressed in exchange for their conversion from Catholicism. While attempts at proselytizing had also been made before the famine, a new and more intense campaign was funded from Britain, especially between the years 1848 and 1850. The evangelical preachers, teachers, and clergy had no shortage of people to attend their services and schools. Indeed, their offers of material comforts in exchange for conversion had a high degree of short-term success in some of the most deprived areas of the West." And then there's testimonies from the people who gave these interviews in the 1940s of what they heard from the survivors. So one from Wexford said, "The soup kitchen was set up by the Protestant Society. They used to give tracts to the men to take home to their families. I never heard of the soup being given except for renouncing the faith. People would renounce their faith for a time being in the hope of going back to the old faith as soon as times got better." And then also another one from Cavan. "Relief committees were set up at Bailyburgh and Shercock, and the Indian meal came as the first relief. The landlords had boilers for boiling soup and Indian porridge. Lord Farnham of Cavan had soup kitchens, and any Catholic who went to him and turned Protestant or ate bacon or beef on Fridays got as much soup and meat as they wanted to take." We've got to remember these are recollections in the 1940s from people who had heard the stories from survivors, so they are second hand. And there's another historian called Barron who wrote a book called Superism, Myth or Reality, and he says that clerical cooperation was the norm and charges of superism were exaggerated. But exaggerated or not, it does seem to have been a reality, and certainly is the perception that it was widespread and common. And so that is a legacy that we've inherited from that period and from the famine, and it's something that we need to bear in mind as we engage and as we think about that relationship between evangelism and social action. Part of the issue then for these 19th century evangelicals also was their Anglo-Irish identity. It wasn't a grassroots Irish movement. Prominent amongst their leaders were the aristocracy, lords, earls, judges, privy councillors, even the Lord Mayor of Dublin. And much of the activity was on the landlord's estates. As evangelicals, they enthusiastically cultivated a British or Anglo-Irish identity. And according to one of the historians, Whelan, she says that the evangelicals saw themselves as a colony in a hostile country. And as if to illustrate that, in the 1830s and 40s, different colonies were actually set up in the country where converts could go and live together. The best known one on Ackle, an Irish-speaking evangelical Nangle set up. Another one in Dingle, which had quite a substantial community before the famine. And others in Doon, Ballingarry, Ballybunion and Listowel. So culturally, there was a great distance between these evangelicals and their culture and the ordinary Irish. And much of the social action was very paternalistic. Now from the 1870s on, that kind of close relationship between the evangelicals and the establishment was more and more evident. In 1870, you have the disestablishment of the Church of Ireland. And from then on, the evangelicals in the Church of Ireland become less vocal, less confident, less involved. They begin to concentrate more on preserving their culture and their political future, become more polarized, more involved in politics of unionism versus home rule. And also internationally, at that turn of the century, it was a time where there was a real loss of confidence for evangelicalism. It's the rise of Darwinism, of higher criticism of the Bible, the emergence of the liberal social gospel movement, and also premillennialism, with its pessimism about the world and the future, began to predominate. So where before postmillennialism had dominated, and most of the reformers, Wilberforce and Newton and Shaftesbury and those guys had been postmillennialists, premillennialism, with a pessimism that the world was going to get worse until Jesus came back, began to dominate. So evangelicalism went on the retreat in America, retreated into fundamentalism, and in England retreat from the world, a personal holiness movement. In Ireland, 1911 to 1926, the Church of Ireland declined by 34% in the south. We don't know, there hasn't been research how many of them were evangelicals or what was the divide. But it seems many of the evangelicals moved northward around the foundation of the state. And from 1922 on, the new state began to act with the Catholic Church to enshrine Catholic social teaching in legislation. And really from there on, evangelicalism becomes an invisible minority. And there's been very little work done specifically on them, apart from kind of around flashpoints and high-profile incidents over the last 50 or 60 years. In the last 30 years then, or 35 years, the picture has changed significantly. From such a low base, evangelicalism has begun to grow, still in or around 1%. But there are interesting statistics, such as that 65% of all evangelical churches were started in the last 25 to 30 years. And also very interesting, about 43% of today's evangelicals are from a Catholic background. So very different situation from the 19th century, much more healthy scenario in terms of a grassroots movement more rooted in Ireland and more Irish in identity. In relation to social action then, over this more modern period, I think as Irish evangelicals, we've tended to define ourselves sometimes more in light of the much larger Catholic Church. The Catholic Church, while it's changing, is still very active socially, and very involved in and socially engaged in the educational sphere, healthcare, tackling poverty, youth services. CORI, the Congregation of Religious Ireland, represents over 10,000 men and women religious, and you know has a public voice into all major policy arenas, and aims to provide accurate social analysis each year of the budget and of government policy. And I think as evangelicals historically in this period have been much more comfortable emphasising the role of faith and grace and personal relationship and keeping social activism in the background, defining ourselves in light of the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church are about social action, we're about faith. Perhaps on a more subconscious level, as it's hard to argue against the call biblically to be involved socially, as we saw at the beginning. And then also in relation to this relationship between the two in more modern times, I think the small size in relation to the surrounding population is a significant factor to be grappled with. Most evangelical churches draw from a very, very large area. If it's in the country, many of the churches in country towns draw from people from 30, 40 miles from the town. I know we do in Wexford. And in Dublin, many of the churches draw from very large communities, 100,000 people. And so the notion of a parish, the notion of an area of interest in which we seek to meet the physical and spiritual needs of a particular people can be overwhelming because it's just too vast an area and we're too small within it. And so when we concentrate simply on individuals and those who come to our churches, we can lose that notion of rootedness in a community and move us one step further away from thinking about the physical needs within that community. So perhaps we need to begin to think again in terms of a parish, a smaller area of interest where we can concentrate our resources and meet the needs even while we draw people from further afield. So that's really by way of thinking about our context and thinking about the history and what we're speaking into and how we might be received as we think about the relationship. So then, secondly then, I just want to think in terms of that relationship. How can we best express it? Evangelism and social action, how can they best relate? The Lausanne Conference in 1974 is often seen as the conference that kicked off the whole debate about the relationship between evangelism and social action. Primarily, it was a conference, an international conference on evangelism, but the tone of the meetings and the final covenant that was produced by the conference reflected a mood of repentance in relation to social action. The covenant at the end stated, they affirmed that, quote, evangelism and socio-political involvement are both part of our Christian duty. John Stott, who was one of the main leaders at that conference, he talked about a half century of neglect in relation to social action. He talked about, described it as a recovery of our temporarily mislaid social conscience. In the 70s and 80s then, further international conferences followed, which repeatedly stated the priority of evangelism. They concluded it was legitimate to talk about social activity as a consequence of evangelism, or a bridge to evangelism, or a partner of evangelism, was how they began to define it. And then the experience of evangelicals in South Africa then, in the 1980s, was very formative. One writer, Bosch, talks about the evangelicals in South Africa and their experience. He says, in the context of the apartheid system, evangelicals felt forced to respond and articulate their views on evangelism, mission, structural evil, and the church's responsibility with respect to justice in society. They had no doubt that they were called to a ministry of proclaiming Christ as Savior, but they were equally convinced that sin was both personal and structural, that life was off a piece, that dualism was contrary to the gospel, and that their ministry had to be broadened as well as deepened. And then fast forward to the beginning of this century, 2001, the MICA network, you may have heard of, is a coalition of evangelical churches and agencies from around the world committed to mission. MICA network, obviously taken from the verse in Micah 6 verse 8, "He has shown you, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you? To act justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly with your God." At the beginning of the 2001, there was a consultation in Oxford by the MICA network, and they issued what was called the MICA Declaration on Integral Mission. And the MICA network talk about what's called integral mission. And let me just quote you this declaration. They say, "It is not simply that evangelism and social action are to be done alongside each other. Rather, in integral mission, our proclamation has social consequences as we call people to love and repentance in all areas of life. And our social involvement has evangelistic consequences as we bear witness to the transforming grace of Jesus Christ. As in the life of Jesus, being, doing, and saying are at the heart of our integral task." So the commitment of the MICA network is really to keep proclamation and demonstration together. It's as much about making evangelism integral with social action as making social action integral with evangelism. One of the books that I found very helpful in looking at this was Tim Keller's book. You may have come across it, called Ministries of Mercy. And I had a really snazzy PowerPoint show to show you off it, Anna. It's just not working, unfortunately. There's a diagram that he has in the book, which I can show you afterwards, is very helpful. He's talking about social action as part of cooperating with God as he seeks to bring wholeness and deal with the alienation which has been part of the human condition since the fall. He describes four alienations, if you like. And he has a diagram which is basically four concentric circles coming out from the middle. At the center, he talks about theological alienation, or alienation from God, and says that at our core from the fall, that's what went wrong, if you like. Theological alienation from God. Genesis 3 verse 8, as God walks in the garden and Adam and Eve hide from him, that we're alienated from God. As you go through the Old Testament, a sinful people can't dwell with a holy God. But then coming out from that, then in the next circle, if you like, is psychological alienation. Alienation from self. Genesis 3 verse 10, they were naked and felt shame. There was enmity between Adam and Eve. Adam begins to blame Eve. Where there was peace in ourselves becomes disintegration, leads to anxiety, shame, guilt, depression, all sorts of outworkings of that alienation within society, an alienation from self. And then as the ripples go out, the next circle beyond that then, social alienation, alienation from others. In Genesis, again, Genesis 3, 12 and 13. Sorry, that's the one. Adam starts to blame Eve. Yeah, alienation from others. And, of course, an outworking of that in terms of conflict and wars and strife. And then the outer circle then, physical alienation, alienation from nature. And Genesis 3, 17 and 19, as the ground is cursed. And the curse is that, you know, thorns and thistles, and it will be hard work tilling the ground. And so Keller talks about it as the church being both the model of God's rule and the agent of God's rule. The model of God's rule, as in, it's to be a new society within which the world can take note of what family dynamics, business practices, race relations, and all of life can be under the kingship of Jesus as he begins to bring healing to those alienations from the outer circle, or from the inner circle out, as he deals with our reconciliation with God, the alienation from God, and begins to heal each of those on the way out. And then as a church, we can be an agent of the kingdom. Is about working for the healing of persons, families, relationships and nations. It's doing deeds of mercy and seeking justice. I find the diagram very helpful in that, as you think about it, on the outer parts, the needs are much more visible. As you move more towards the core, it takes the Holy Spirit to show people their greatest need and deepest need, the alienation from God. And on the outer circle, as you're dealing with it, it's more to do with deeds ministry. And as you get closer to the centre, it's more to do with word ministry. That's a helpful way of looking at it, I find. Other authors that have helped me, or thinkers in this area, is Tim Chester and Steve Timmons in their book Total Church. And they talk about three kind of balancing statements in terms of evangelism and social action, which I think are very helpful. They say, the first one is that evangelism and social action are distinct activities. Evangelism is about proclaiming the good news, about conveying the message of God's love, an opportunity for reconciliation with God. It has eternal consequences, and that's distinct from social action. Social action is about effecting change in history. By nature, it's temporary. It can be undone. So there are distinct activities, evangelism and social action. And the temptation is to think in our social action that we're doing evangelism, but we're not. We're loving people, we're meeting people's needs, which are physical, and we're dealing with the outer circles of need, if you like, which is necessary, but different and distinct from the inner need, that inner circle, reconciliation with God. So good to keep that in mind, that they're distinct activities. That's their first statement. Second statement they make in balancing is that proclamation is central. That social action can convey that we love people. It can convey that God is a God of love. God is interested in people and their needs. But there must be a verbal message to it. There must be a proclamation that God has provided a way for us to be reconciled to him. There must be a call to repentance. There must be some point in the relationship where we convey that message. That's got to be central. The greatest need of the poor, as much as of the rich, is for reconciliation with God, for that inner need to be met. So evangelism and social action are distinct activities. Proclamation is central. And then their third balancing statement is evangelism and social action are inseparable. That we can't treat people in isolation. That we come to people in relationship, that we deal with the whole person, that we're called to love, and centrally, to love someone is to proclaim the gospel to them. But inseparable with that is meeting whatever needs we can meet in their life. As we relate to them, as we're involved in their lives, that has a context. And loving them will involve both activities, even if, while centrally, we want them to know reconciliation with him. So it's what Mike at Network calls integral mission. That we make our evangelism integral with our social action, and our social action integral with our evangelism. That the two go together. They give quite a good example in terms of, they give the example of godliness. And they say, if you substitute the word social action, or putting godliness instead of social action, it's easier to think about it. If you think godliness and evangelism are distinct activities, they're different. In godliness, we're called to be kind, patient, truthful, honest, etc. That's not the same thing as explaining the gospel to someone. At the same time, godliness is not a replacement for evangelism. They're not alternatives to be prioritized. I won't be godly this week, I'm too busy with evangelism. We're called to both, and we're called to live both, and we're called to integrate both in our lives. Godliness should always accompany our evangelism and reinforce it. So in that sense, they're inseparable. We wouldn't say that godliness is a tactic for evangelism. We're godly simply because that's what God has called us to. Let me just finish with a brief word our situation in Wexford and just try and ground it a bit more. As a church in Wexford, our temptation is, I guess, to have events that are evangelistic and events that meet physical needs. Well, if I'm totally honest, it's really to have events that are evangelistic. Because that's what we know how to do. That's what we're comfortable with. Maybe it's difficult, but that's certainly what we know and what we're comfortable with. But where we have both, the temptation is to have them separate, to have an evangelistic event, to have an event that meets physical needs or meets that social action needs in isolation, unrelated. The temptation is not to have mission which is integral, which recognizes their distinct activities, but that we're called to engage in a way that engages the whole person. One example is we run good news clubs in two kind of disadvantaged estates in Wexford, two council estates. And there, you could argue there's a social action element to those clubs, but primarily they're evangelistic. However, at Christmas time, we put together Christmas hampers for the families of the children involved in the Good News Clubs. Many of them have been hit with the recession hard, and it's a way of helping, it's a way of loving the families, part of loving them as whole people. We bring the hampers to the families as well. And then also part of loving that whole community, which the families are part of, we've got involved where we can on their estate. The local community group was given a house in the council estate. As a church, we got involved in painting the house for them, offering our services where we could over 3 or 4 weekends, men from the church going and painting the house for them. Not conditional on anything, and simply part of what it means to love those families and that community, while at the same time seeking opportunities to proclaim and seeking opportunities to serve. So in that way, trying to make it integral, trying to make the two mesh. Or one individual that I know, I've known since I was in Wexford, over the years, he's not a Christian yet, has many problems, has been in and out of alcoholism, addictions. I take every opportunity I can to explain the gospel to him. But a lot of the time that I spend with him is ferrying him to the doctor, or bringing him shopping, or bringing him for meals, feeding him. And so in that sense, the evangelism and the social action are inseparable, even though in my mind they're distinct activities and the proclamation is central and I want them to become a Christian. I guess love means giving one's neighbour whatever he or she needs. Of course, the gospel is the primary need, that central need in the diagram. But there are other needs as well we want to try and meet and love the person as a whole person. Okay, I guess that's it. But I hope that sparked a few ideas or questions or whatever in you. Eddie was going to...
Yeah, we got started a bit, half an hour after we were meant to start, and we're meant to end in about another 6-7 minutes. But there is opportunity to start, John. What was it? Well, because you're all at dinner, that's fine.
Yeah.
Why were you late, John? Do you want to confess why you were late? No, okay. So, if you
want... Yeah, we had a problem with the screen.
Yeah, we've got the screen.
Sorry, man.
You don't need to do that. You know, you're not happy. You're going to do it all. Yeah, well, we can't stay on a little bit longer, 5-10 minutes longer if you want, if you get a bit cool, but take questions if you want to ask a question, nice opportunity, we have time for questions, or you want to make a remark, please keep the comment short if you can. But the floor is open for questions.
Dialogue feeds your consumerism back in the famine times, still haunt people today. When you run your kids' club and perhaps feed people and stuff like that, is it still in people's psyche that what is this church doing and are people suspicious or have you
No, I would say I haven't ever been accused and haven't come across it in our context. Where I spoke before, and we opened the floor of this, a lot of people did testify that it was an issue in their area. And so I think there are pockets around the country and places around the country where it is still in the very long memory, or it is an issue. I guess, in my mind, as we run those kind of events, or where there is that link, I guess in my mind it's important that it's never one is never conditional on the other, you know? So we're giving food hampers, whether the children come back to Good News Club or not, and whether they came to all meetings during the year or they came to one or what, you know. Where it becomes an issue would be if you were making it conditional.
One example of why it's important is we have a church planter in Waterloo who, when he launched the church, if you had the first meeting, got a €10 Tesco voucher. But I don't think he's going to be our interest.
Some would argue that what we're about is a great commission. You know, have you any comments on that? Have you thought that one through?
Well, in terms of the Great Commission, which goes on to say, teaching them everything that I have, everything that I have commanded you, yes? Which includes all of this teaching in terms of loving your neighbour. And some people talk about the Great Commission and the Great Commandment in terms of loving God with all our heart, soul, and mind, and our neighbour as ourself. So in terms of social action, it's certainly a part of loving people, you know, and that's where it comes in. So it comes in as we try to love people and love the whole person, and it comes in the Great Commission in terms of teaching them everything I have commanded you. I'm not sure if that's...
So like we said about it not being an either or, but the reality of church resources and time and effort means it should be an either or, but sometimes it has to be because of priorities and limited time. How do you deal with that?
I think you're right. Sometimes in terms of resources, it has to be. I think this is where we need to be intentional about it, and we need to try and think ahead and see how we can integrate both, you know? And so seek to love the whole person, you know? Sometimes I guess it's easier to think of it in terms of as an individual being involved in evangelism with other individuals. And that's where it's easiest to think of it, because you're loving the whole person and you're engaging with the whole person and their needs. As a church, we may put on programs, and we may put on a program that is purely evangelistic or purely social action, you know? I think we ought to be equipping our people to be people who engage on the level of the whole person and seek to love the whole person and find ways of meeting the needs of the people they're engaging with.
First, thanks very much, Jonathan. That was great. Very insightful. I suppose the question running from this, Joel Edwards, who I think was behind the mic,
possibly,
spoke recently in Cork and was encouraging working alongside in terms of multi-faith work of working alongside people from different persuasions in areas of justice and social action because they were good things that were to be done. Are those things, is that a good thing to do because they are broad issues? And how far do we go with that? Because that is a lot, I guess that's what I'm coming across as a church pastor leader, that get involved in social action, but also get involved with other
It's a hard one sometimes to square, isn't it? I suppose in my own experience in Wexford, I've got involved with the whole fair trade campaign. I'm on the committee in the town for the last 5 or 6 years, and we've worked at getting Wexford recognised as a fair trade town, which happened a few years ago. And in one sense, I suppose I'm involved in that simply because it's a good thing to be involved in. And it's working for justice in the third world. And so I suppose, do I have to defend it any more than that? It's a good thing to be involved in. On the other hand, as I'm involved in it with the other committee members, I've had fantastic opportunities to share my faith with them and to talk about the motivation with them one-to-one as to why I'm involved in it. And as a church, our church was the first church that was involved in one of the campaigns in highlighting particular fair trade tea and coffee after the service. But on the one-to-one level with those guys on the committee, I've had fantastic opportunities. And I suppose my motivation in all of it is still, yes, is to see justice done, which is a good thing. And on a one-to-one level with these individuals, yeah, is to see them become Christians. I'm not sure if that's answering your question, but yeah.
Mr. Maiden and then Mr. Ritchie.
Just on the Cooperism issue, I'm not sure, you know, we always hear that particular word, but in some areas of the country maybe more so. But I've heard people talk about, oh, that's the carrot to get them. Or does that hurt? Does my daughter have to go to a church to be in that? There's a suspicion in Ireland, I think. And that shapes how we approach evangelism. Do you think, how much do you think that affects our evangelism and how we need to be with people? Do we need to take more time with people because they have this, there's still something, I think there's still a deep rooted suspicion.
And I suppose I, as you say, I can recognise we have come across that as a church, you know, just a deeper kind of suspicion, wanting to know exactly what's the agenda here, or what's going to be involved in it, you know. And I don't know, maybe it is a legacy deep rooted going back. And I guess the only answer is in our practice over time and as we build relationships, to show that we're simply want to love the people, simply want their good and haven't got a hidden agenda, and don't make it conditional on anything, you know, and be as open and transparent, you know, I would say.
Do we serve the community? And we understand the community essentially by parents and daughters. We in our church, we're living with the other brothers, we do that, other churches, and we're also AA, and we provide a focus for them, and thankfully we were able to do that with a Christian person. So I think let's get across and even get it from serving the community. And by the grace of God, some will come into your church to buy, but the need is there and the responsibility.
Mm.
I was just thinking about, you know, from what your example is saying, that you're pretty clear in your mind, you know, what are you trying to get into. But where, in terms of as a church where they were congregation members or such, they pick up the ideas, but yet they are not clear in their mind, you know, about the balance of social action and evangelism. And if there's a case of where social action is overtaken, you know, the priority, I mean, how would we draw the balance in terms of other members of the church? I mean, how do you work your view on that?
I mean, I guess it's in teaching, you know, it's in talking, you know, about our calling to love. In one sense, none of this is rocket science, really, for people to pick up. It's simply getting them to engage with their friends and neighbours and getting them to love them. And, you know, that will mean more than simply what they say to them. It won't be less than that, and that will be central to it. But it also involves serving. It can you know, widen out from that area. But it's as we teach and as we model, simply loving and serving in our communities and to individuals.
Question: I come across where supers and friends course as well, but I'm always amazed to find that if there's ever any monument open to the family or anything, they're all the time wanting to find where can we find the nearest Quaker to commemorate what the Quakers did.
Yes.
So the Quakers were part of the evangelical, but the different was saying to the other people. And yes. I wouldn't mention because something about their heart and their the nature by which they do the work in the community. Not wanting to be up front, but quite behind the scenes. And there's something about Jesus there to be.
In my dissertation, I look at the Quakers in a good deal of depth, it's a fascinating case study in a sense, in that they come out glowingly from the famine, and in fact, the British government changed their policy in terms of relief for the famine based on what the Quakers were doing, in that they were setting up the soup kitchens. Where previously the government had simply been given out grain, so then the government took on their policy and began to set up government-run soup kitchens. And to the extent, remembered to the extent that the 1937 Constitution, in its first format, recognised the Quakers, so listed the Christian denominations in the country, and you know the ones that you would expect, and then set the Society of Friends as well. Which, you know, oughtn't really to be there in terms of their size, but was a remembrance of the famine and their work. But having said that, they are a case study of where social action and evangelism as a relationship of the two didn't quite get it right through their history, in that social action became evangelism, got merged into one. They didn't remain distinct activities. And as I looked through their history as they come into the 20th century and even to today, there is an evangelical Quaker missionary in Greystones. I had a long conversation with her and she said it's very rare to find an evangelical Quaker today. They're still involved in social action, in prison visiting and visitor centres in prison stuff, but many of them are not are not evangelicals, and many of them are looking to, you know, even drop the label Christian. So it's a case where the one just became so big that the balance wasn't maintained, that they weren't kept as distinct activities or integrated. So it's an interesting sketch, yeah.
I just meant to say thank you to Jonathan. Thanks for your appreciation, Jonathan.
Thank you.
I wish I wasn't there. I had loads of things to say about Superism, and the rethinking that's been on at the moment, and some of the stuff was about that. But enough on this. Any more time? Let me just.